Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Korupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the media and corporate double standards surrounding Maria Sharapova and how they're indicative of anti-Russian sentiment. So Russian tennis champion Maria Sharapova supposedly fails a drug test, and the sports world is up in arms about it, with Nike even suspending their cooperation with her. Now guys, let me say, I don't think any athlete should use banned substances no matter what they are, and I think it's regretful that so many sports figures are taking performance-enhancing drugs and supplements no matter whether they're legal or not, but let me put this into perspective. Sharapova didn't fail a drug test in the way that the media might lead you all to believe. She didn't have steroids or cocaine in her system, if that's what you were thinking. Instead, she failed for something called meldonium, which was only just made illegal at the start of this year. She'd been taking the substance for over a decade, and it just increases blood flow, which experts say improves exercise capacity. In her defense, it can also be used for non-sports-related reasons as well, and she says that she's been taking it for as long as she has because of her magnesium deficiency and family history of diabetes. So, like any self-respecting person should do, she held a press conference and came out and admitted that she failed the test for this substance, taking full responsibility and ownership for what had happened, and I sincerely applaud her for that, even though she didn't fail intentionally, and this is all an unfortunate misunderstanding on her part. But what happened next was despicable, and that's the blowback that she's receiving in the global press and the amount of attention that the story has garnered, which, like I said, resulted in Nike and some of her other sponsors such as Porsche suspending their deals with her, obviously impacting negatively on her planned finances and meant to be some sort of public shaming event, if you ask me. They can do whatever they want. They're private, independent companies, but you know, it just strikes me odd that they didn't do this to other athletes that failed for even worse substances. In fact, it seems to me, as an observer in all of this, that this regretful episode is being taken completely out of proportion and used as some sort of anti-Russian information offensive, trying to make it all seem like all Russian athletes dope up and might also be taking some secret or shady drugs, whether legal or not. So, why do I think this? Well, it's pretty simple, actually. Let's look at the sports-related propaganda against Russia during the Sochi Winter Olympics, or even all that commotion about FIFA a few months ago, which had the strong influence of possibly taking the 2008 World Cup away from Russia. In this instance, there aren't such high stakes involved, but they're more personal, in fact, with the objective being to get the global media and sports audience to doubt the authenticity of every Russian athlete's victory, to draw it into question and infer that it was illegally acquired through drugs. When we put it all into context and look at it from the relevant angle, there's no other way to explain the media and private companies' double standards towards Maria Sharapova than to link them to a passive-aggressive information campaign against Russia. The next one up is Pope Francis declaring that Europe is undergoing a, quote, Arab invasion. So Pope Francis obviously turned a lot of heads with this statement, but while the wording was certainly provocative, it doesn't seem like his intent was to cause a stir. His exact words were, quote, today we can speak of an Arab invasion, it is a social fact, while qualifying his statements by saying that, again, quote, it has always been able to overcome them, moving forward and finding itself better through the exchange between cultures. We can learn a lot from the set of quotes because they're quite revealing, as are how they've been reported on as well. Francis is acknowledging the reality of large-scale Arab, mostly Muslim, migration to Europe, whether as refugees or economic migrants, and he calls it an invasion because demographically, it sure seems to be. But, unlike most people that use that terminology, he does not mean it necessarily in a bad way, and thinks that Europe can become more culturally enriched by it. Supporters of this viewpoint end up looking at the Islamization of Andalusia, the southern part of Spain, which was Muslim for around 700 years. But, since we're talking about the history of Arab invasions, or to be more broadly inclusive, Muslim migration to Europe, it's worthwhile bringing up another side of things, and that's the Ottoman occupation of the Balkans, which lasted for nearly half a millennium, and was marked by brutal acts such as the impaling of Serbian Christians who did not forcibly convert to Islam. Opponents of this large-scale Muslim migration to Europe point out that Sharia law might start being imposed in some of the migrant ghettos in Europe. And unlike the Pope, they don't think that this uncontrollable migration, or as Francis himself calls it, invasion, is something beneficial for the local inhabitants. It's not out of racism or fascism or white supremacy, but simply that host populations will always have challenges assimilating and integrating any large amount of migrants, but that it's even more difficult when they're civilizationally dissimilar and some of them just don't want to integrate. So this brings me around to briefly talking about how the issue is reported on in Europe. Those that favor open borders and no assimilative or integrative policies whatsoever are viewing Francis's statements as something positive, as though he's using his normative authority to promote a blending of civilizations. It's typically left-wing outlets that feel this way. On the other hand, those that want to control borders and support the assimilation and integration of migrants into their host societies see Francis as naively optimistic and unwilling to see the problems that have arisen, although, as they see it, quite rightly pointing out that this is an, quote, an invasion. Mostly, as could be guessed, these are conservative or right-wing publications and individuals. All in all, there are extremists on both sides, be it the militant left-wing or the shameless neo-Nazis, but the moderates on both sides make their fair points on the subject. Still, if you ask me, what's happening in Europe is that it's a victim of what Kelly M. Greenhill calls weapons of mass migration, and that no matter how optimistic Francis wants to be about it, I think that this situation is going to get a lot more destabilizing in the coming future. Earlier in the week, the right-wing neoliberal Venezuelan opposition, which won an electoral landslide late last year, said that they are commencing a plan to remove President Maduro, and that this will include street protests, a referendum, and a constitutional change. It seems like everyone saw this coming, and it was totally predictable that they'd do this. But all that this means is that the future is now totally unpredictable. None of us knows exactly what they're planning in detail, nor how they plan to carry it out. We can analyze their capabilities and history to get a generalized idea of what to expect in the coming weeks. Let me begin by reminding you all that the U.S. has concrete geostrategic interests in ousting President Maduro, and these have to do with his pragmatic relationships with Russia and China. But even more importantly, the Orinoco River oil deposits that lay in the southeast of the country. These are also the world's largest untapped reserves. The U.S. already has enough oil inside its borders and currently receives a good amount of its imports from Venezuela. But what it wants to do is to control this resource in order to deny it to China or use it as a future blackmail instrument. Having said that, anything that the pro-American and American-linked opposition says and does, and let's remember that some of its members have been back and forth to the American embassy and even in Miami to meet with government officials, that it's really the U.S. acting here via its localized proxy force. The U.S.'s guys and gals on the ground, so to speak, have a history of violent color revolution unrest, the most recent incident being back in 2014, 2 years ago. They provoked a riot in Caracas that led to some deaths and even more civilian casualties. Leopoldo Lopez, one of the organizers, was later arrested and is currently serving time in prison. With that as a precedent, we can certainly expect those protests to actually be a euphemism for color revolution violence. The thing is, many people might naively join in and support them because the economic war against the country, combined with the government's obvious mismanagement, has created a dire situation for the regular person. Plus, let's remember how many people voted for the opposition in the last polls a couple months back, so there's clearly some pre-existing resentment for them to build upon. My forecast is that the U.S. is getting ready to unleash its pre-planned hybrid war regime change strategy against Maduro, in which a color revolution and unconventional warfare, such as guerrilla insurgency and or outright terrorism, will be used to try to topple him. The referendum and constitutional change are other parallel tracks that will be pursued. And if they succeed, then the hybrid war will be called off. But I predict that the hybrid war will intensify around the time of any possible referendum, or even if the government officially announces that there won't be any at all. Then, this will be the trigger for an escalation. No matter which way we look at it, folks, I think that we can all agree that the future does not look too bright for Venezuela in the short term. Our runner-up is the Pentagon carrying out the world's deadliest ever drone strike in Somalia and what it means for the Horn of Africa region. What happened in Somalia at the beginning of this week was something unprecedented, and is that upwards of 150 al-Shabaab terrorists were killed by a joint drone and aircraft strike, which the Pentagon initially said was only a drone strike. Take Washington's word for it, the terrorists were a military formation at the time of their bombing, and that the strike was utterly devastating to them and initiated a stop to what was described as an imminent terrorist attack against the U.S. and African Union troops in Somalia. To put it all into context, a minor bomb blew up on a passenger jet a few weeks back, and there was another attempted airport attack recently as well. And of course, we're dealing with terrorists, so there's obviously some credibility to what the Pentagon purported. But I'm not interested, nor do I think you are, in me going on a polemic spree talking about if this was good or bad. I want to widen your understanding of things and hopefully teach you a few things along the way. So I'm going to talk a bit more about al-Shabaab and the threat that it poses to the region. As a quick backgrounder, the terrorist group grew out of the Islamic Courts Union that overran warlord-infested Somalia in 2006 and was finally defeated by an Ethiopian invasion, one which was supported by the U.S. There are a lot of reports circulating stating that Qatar supports al-Shabaab because of their shared radical vision, and it wouldn't surprise me if they were true. So, this group, al-Shabaab, obviously operates within Somalia and has problems with Ethiopia, which I'd like to tell you all has a very geographically large Somali region along the border and a sizable Muslim plurality in general. Ethiopia has been one of al-Shabaab's targets since the 2006 invasion and is still a hated foe. But another one is Kenya, which, because it borders Somalia, has a lot of troops there as part of the African Union contingent, thus making it another one of al-Shabaab's enemies. The group carried out the Westgate Mall attack and college killings over the past couple of years, and Kenyan troops were recently killed by al-Shabaab in one of their earlier attacks against African Union troops this year. Basically, al-Shabaab has problems with its two main neighbors, not counting Djibouti, where a threat does realistically exist too, meaning that the U.S. has drawn an aviation strike, as much as it may have been against international law, if it was not coordinated with the government, which it might have been, serves the interest of these two economic powers, Ethiopia and Kenya. Interestingly, they're both economically moving closer to China nowadays, but it's through military cooperation, coordination even with the U.S., that Washington is able to retain its influence over them to a practical extent, given how much of a threat al-Shabaab is, and how they don't seem to be going away anytime soon and might even lash out against either of these two countries or stage even another airplane bombing attempt. It's likely that the Pentagon will keep attacking it in Somalia, much to the joy of politicians in Addis Ababa and Nairobi. At our top spot, we've got Erdogan seizing the opposition newspaper Zaman and dismantling the last vestiges of Turkey's so-called democracy. Erdogan went on another power trip, this time against his own people, and I'm not talking about the Kurds. By seizing the Zaman media outlet, he destroyed the last bastion of free media in the country, and has put Turkey on the road to becoming a one-party state. Remember, folks, the AK party did not win the first round of elections last year, and in the last one, they only pulled through with the majority because they appealed to the nationalist vote, the Grey Wolves, officially the MHP, through Erdogan's war on the Kurds. Erdogan decided to carry out his media coup at this given point in time because he knows that opposition is growing to his rule. And while having planned this for some time, he knew that there's been a lot of international opposition to him if he did it before or right after the election. However, now that he has Europe blackmailed through the immigrant crisis, despite their criticism of what are undoubtedly anti-Western values, he's given a free pass because Europe desperately needs him to contain the human tidal wave, which he still doesn't seem willing or interested in doing. Erdogan is thus exploiting the Middle Eastern and other migrants in order to carry out certain internal and external political moves. Internally, he is using his trump card in the immigrant crisis to wantonly kill the Kurds, without any substantial consequences from his Western partners besides sharp rhetoric. And now he's carrying his purge over to intensifying his crackdown on the constitutional and legal opposition through his destruction of free media. On the foreign front, he's surfing the human tidal wave in order to accelerate his country's accession to the EU and get visa-free travel privileges for its citizens, which essentially could institutionalize the immigrant crisis anyhow. Also, there's talk that he's putting pressure on Greece to agree to a lasting and legal settlement for Cyprus. the northern part of which Turkey has illegally occupied for the past 4 decades. Overall, we see that Erdogan is using this crisis, which he helped manufacture alongside the U.S., to boost his general power, but that the unintentional, albeit expected, blowback is that he is generating a significant amount of dedicated opposition to his rule. Many regular folks in the EU absolutely hate him, as do his own people. Well, the opposition, anyhow. By neutering free speech in his country, Erdogan is trying to prevent the large-scale dissemination of counter-information to his rule and mitigate the chances of what he thinks will be a color revolution against him. But that's the thing, guys. A color revolution's number one critical component is foreign support, and I don't think the Turkish protesters would have it to that extent. I mean, any protest they do would be entirely endemic and natural, an outgrowth of disgust from the Turkish people. So whatever we call it, color revolution or democratic uprising, Erdogan senses that it's becoming more likely, hence his drastic moves at trying to stop it, spitting in the face of free speech and desperately suppressing it however he can. And then, as the cherry on top of all of this, guys, you have Angela Merkel, poster woman for EU values, bowing down and letting the Sultan do as he pleases. What a shame. Alrighty, guys, this concludes this week's episode of Context Countdown. Thank you again so much for listening to my program, and I strongly encourage you all to share it on social media. Thank you again, have a wonderful weekend, and talk to you next week. Bye.